Welcome to Cult Talk with Aaron Martin, a conversation, not an investigation. Cult Talk is a podcast that explores the realities of cult life, how they operate, who joins them, why people stay, and how some members eventually find their way out. Season one of Cult Talk will focus on a little-known cult called the COBU, which stands for the Church of Bible Understanding, led by Stuart Trail. In episode 8 of Cult Talk, I chat with Catherine Armstrong, who reached out to me to share her story of being in COBU for many, many years, some of which even overlapped with my mom and dad back in the 1970s, the early days of the cult's fragile beginnings. She talks about how COBU recruited her and some of her friends while they were still in high school, how Stuart manipulatively pitted members against one another in his infamous color coding system that ranked members, and how she continually strived to be, quote, the right woman according to COBU's impossible standards. Here's part one of my two-part interview with COBU survivor Catherine Armstrong. Well, Kathy, thank you for talking with me today. I know that we contacted one another. I think you reached out to me on an ex-COBU page, and you actually knew my mom and my dad in the COBU.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I was 15 and I remember them. And I remember looking up to them because anyone that was like 5 years older than us, we just revered them and thought they were great.
It's funny.
Plus, they were so friendly.
they're friendly people. It's funny though, because you say you were 15 and I was like, wow, that's young. I always think of my parents as so young in the group. And they yes. were 20, 21.
Yeah.
You know? So, but 15.
Yep.
So were you still living with your parents? Like, how did you come upon this group?
So my best friends who lived down the street, they got involved. Their older sister did first. Then they got involved. And because we were so close, they kept saying, well, when are you going to come down? And when are you going to come down and see it? And I hesitated and hesitated because it was just, I was very skeptical of it. And I wasn't raised to go to church. And I just wasn't sure what I was thinking about this. And this was my first year at high school. So I gave it a little bit of time and then I went down and brought some friends. And the very first day, wow, it really hits you because the older members, you know, like in their 19 or early 20s, they were so happy to see you. They were very welcoming and kind and just wonderful, wonderful to talk to. But then they sat you down and talked about getting saved. Mm-hmm. And becoming a Christian and what that meant. And then they convince you and they don't really let you go. I mean, you're like kind of but all of us were like that. So I'm not trying to say that it was just certain people. We were all trained to really coerce or lead someone to Jesus. That's what it was called. And
right.
So after about an hour, I just thought, well, sure, I want to be saved. I want to be forgiven and I want Jesus to be my savior. Absolutely. And I was searching. I was a young person. I was the first year of high school. I wasn't involved in sports, so I didn't quite have a team. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go to church, so I didn't have, quote, a Christian family or a sense of community. And my family was, I didn't have a large family in Baltimore. They were all in the Midwest. So, yeah, I just was so drawn to them. And the fact that they loved seeing us, we would come down after school in a little Volkswagen and do our little lamb. We would do our nuggies that we were called lambs. So a nuggie was a nugget. You would just get into the Bible and take notes on your file cards. And it was just a wonderful experience because I was learning about Jesus and how the Bible, it was so wonderful. It was just we really were filled with our first love. And that's a verse from the Bible. You have a first love for God. It mm-hmm. was just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
And did your friends come along with you or did you just continue alone? Okay.
No, some of them did. And then some of them would drop out.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Some of them lasted a while. Some of them didn't. But then we became at our high school, which was Towson High School in Baltimore. We created quite a uproar and they made comic strips about us in the newspaper because there was about, at the height of it, it was about maybe 13 of us that would talk to other students. And we would sometimes be sent to the office because we would talk about Jesus. And
really? Okay.
The feisty ones. Yeah. The feisty ones, like we would be reprimanded and we would say things back to the principal like, well, you know, we have to obey God, not you, you know. Wow. Stuff you know, like that.
Oh, you know, there was an arrogance, I think, I think there isn't any cult kind of mentality where it's like, well, if we're getting persecuted for our beliefs, then we're doing something right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because that was what the early Christians, we were modeling ourselves after the early Christians.
Right. Where you give up all your possessions. You just focus on saving other souls. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Did you meet Stuart right away? Did you just meet the other members? I mean, did you have a plan of going to live in, as they say, to live communally? Or how did that work for you? You were so young.
Everybody, the goal was to move in eventually. Yeah. And much to my parents' dismay, I continued through the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade as part of the fellowship. So I wasn't allowed to go to the, quote, big meetings in Allentown, specifically. You know, that's where they were only meeting at that time. I can remember my first time going, I might have been 17. My parents finally relented and I was able to go, and we would all go in vans. And of course, they weren't safe vans either, but we would travel up there and then spend the night and all night Bible studies. It was crazy. It was very, very different for a 15-year-old. And of course, because I was getting in the fellowship further and further, and more devoted in my relationship to God, which meant it was synonymous to your devotion to the fellowship. See, yeah. It was the same exact thing. So if you were a lukewarm Christian, it was because you were not really devoted to coming to the meetings. You could still be close to God in your heart, but not if you weren't in the fellowship and coming to the meetings and witnessing with everybody and going out and proselytizing and just, you know,
right,
things like that. So eventually, when I graduated from high school, about 2 weeks later, I moved in to Manhattan Training Center.
You did. And, okay. Which is where we lived for a time, too.
Ugh, oh, awful.
Yeah. So describe that, because my mom describes it not in a huge detail, but I've heard from so many members just the deplorable conditions in
those
lofts.
I lived with a couple of other sisters who were from the Baltimore area, and we lived in Hell's Kitchen. So we didn't live in the loft. We lived in apartments that had no electricity.
What?
So we had, no electricity. And we used candles, and there were probably roaches all around. And it was a one bedroom. It was a tenement housing. I mean, it was deplorable. It was sad. But then all of the fellowships in the States were equally in poverty stricken areas, and well, most of them anyway.
Most of them were, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, did you question that, or did you just go with it? What was the reasoning given to you?
You know, we were so young and naive, and we were so thankful to be part of something larger than ourselves. And we had a sense of meaning and purpose, albeit misguided at the time, because we were brainwashed and didn't realize it. And because we so much wanted to be right in God's eyes, we really lived that way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, according to the Bible, you deny the pleasures of the flesh. And that might mean electricity. But I didn't last long. So I only was there for a while, maybe a few months, because I left because I wanted to get married. And the man I was having a relationship with, he had left first, but he left because of the oppressive, shameful atmosphere of how the brothers were treated up at the Manhattan Training Center. So there was a time when all the brothers were judged by colors. It was a color-coded system. So I think only Stuart and Gail were silver and gold, you know, and that's what you would aspire to, the silver and gold. But most of us lowly people that were normal teenage members, we were either brown or black or orange. So at that one meeting, I remember I was judged as orange, but the man that I was going to marry was judged as lower brown. And he felt I just remember the look on his face and the shame that all of them had at being judged. You know, and a lot of it depended not really on their relationship with God, but their popularity in the cult. you know,
absolutely. I mean, this is shocking to me. This is shocking to me that you were judged, and it shouldn't be, I guess, after all the stories I've heard about Kopu, but that you were judged publicly and given a color code ranking.
Right. Yeah. See, there were different gimmicks or different processes that were used to keep us, to keep the shame based, to keep us held down. You know, there couldn't be joy or freedom, really.
No, that's how my mom always has described it. She said it just wasn't joyful. But the initial hook got her in the door because she thought it was a joyful, free place.
Well, when you were in the individual fellowships and individual homes, there really was joyful community. I have to say that. It wasn't always doom and gloom. The meetings were. I remember, you know, just dreading them, but knowing I had to go because it was what we were meant to do and what we had to do, you know, in order to grow and whatever. But yeah, so it was the individual homes, you know, were the relationships that we built with one another were really true and healthy, in a sense, healthy. You know what I mean? As healthy as you can be.
As healthy as you can be in that environment, right?
Right, right.
Well, building on that, here's what I always wonder, and I've asked my parents about this. When you start to have those feelings of shame or guilt or start to think this color coding system is crazy, do you begin to talk about that with other members or do you keep that to yourself? Because you do have relationships, you know.
Right. I'm sure there was a lot of discourse about that. I left shortly thereafter. I don't know. I'm sure they talked about it ad nauseum, to tell you the truth, because they would just continually talk about certain things like that. And because you were obsessed with it, you wanted to rise above your low colors.
Wow. And who was I assume Stuart was the judge of this. He was the one who handed out all the proclamations.
No. It was like really he let the group do it. See, that's where he was clever.
Oh.
Yeah. See, he let the individual, the more extroverted ones or the ones that maybe were rising above and were closer to him at that time, you would fall in and out of favor with Stuart, depending on a number of things.
It could be anything.
Yeah. And then,
well, that's master manipulation. So he can take himself out of the equation, but he's really the puppeteer.
Right.
Moving all of the pieces. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So then you left the group and got married, or stayed one foot in?
It's very interesting. Yeah. Yes, I did leave and we got married shortly thereafter.
Okay.
I left from New York and I just couldn't take it. And I called my mom. I took the train to Philadelphia. Then I got off of the train station because I didn't have enough money and I needed to take the bus back to Baltimore. So I was 18 years old. In the middle of the night, I got off of the train in Philadelphia, then walked. I asked this man, "Do you know where the Trailways bus station is?" And so he said, "Sure, I'll walk you there." I was so young and naive.
And
he took me through back roads. But you know what? I was so beside myself of what I was doing. I felt so guilty that I was, quote, leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And when you leave, you backslide. Of course, that's not really true. You can still have a relationship with God, but in the cult's eyes, when you leave, you're a backslider.
Can you explain just briefly what a backslider means to the group?
A backslider means someone who has left their relationship with God and who is totally turned and now is living in the world.
Right. And just to expand on that, it's for listeners who are wondering, I think that's a major part of any cult, and it definitely was with Kobu, where if you left the group, you were leaving God, you were leaving Christianity, you were leaving your state of grace, all of it. So leaving the group wasn't just because people will have the question and say, "Well, why don't you just leave?" You know, but it goes it goes deeper with that, with the manipulation you're fed. So thank you for mentioning that.
Sure. And it was just amazing to me that I was protected walking. And we walked quite a ways from the train station to the bus station with my little satchel of stuff, my little worldly possessions that I did have.
Yeah, you don't have anything when you're leaving either, right?
And it was amazing. Yeah. Here I am, this young white woman in the downtown Philadelphia walking through. And, you know, who knows, maybe he was an angel.
Wow. You know, what year was
getting
this?
Me there safely, because it was in the middle of the night.
Seriously. I mean, that's amazing. Truly. What year was this? You were,
It was 1978.
Okay. So you found the Kobu when you were in 1975 then, when you were 15 and left it in 1978.
Actually, it was 77. It was 77 because my daughter was born in 78. Yep.
Okay. Okay. And then when you got married, your husband was out of the group as well. Did you still remain in contact with anyone? How did that go?
So I didn't remain in contact with anyone because in my eyes, I was, you know, a backslider.
Right.
And I remember someone calling me and saying, when I had reached Baltimore, saying, you know, what's going on? You left. And he happened to be a very kind man, a very kind person. And so we just talked. I said, I can't do it anymore. I just can't. And I wanted to get married. And so he tried to coerce me to come back. in his kind way, but I said nope, and we got married. I had a child, our first child, and then I missed everyone. Mm-hmm. So what did I do? I started contacting them because that was my family. We didn't go to college. We weren't allowed to. Mm-hmm. That was frowned upon because that was of the world. That was education from the worldly point of view, not biblical.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that college was actually frowned upon actively.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow. Okay.
As was any institution, any social constructed institution was frowned upon because only the church, only Stuart and us had the real way.
Wow.
Yeah. So I started contacting them, friends, and wanted to come back because I had missed everyone. And I remember bringing my baby daughter, so happy to see everyone. And I was thinking, wow, I'm rededicating my life now. But my husband didn't go. So I go up there. It was a meeting at Staten Island. And I think actually the Reverend Richard Wormbrand was speaking then.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And what happened was Gail saw me from a distance. She must have known I'd left. She didn't even really know who I was really well. She must have heard about me or a little bit or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And just to clarify, Gail is Stuart's
wife. Gail is Stuart's, right. Mm-hmm. So she came, right. And they'd been married by this time about maybe 3 or 4 years. Yeah. I don't know exactly.
About that.
And so she was, again, someone who was so revered, and everything that came out of her mouth and Stuart's mouth was just like, wow, she talked to you? What? You know, like, so she came up to me and I was so happy to see everyone. I mean, I was actually joyful to be back with the people that I felt closest to in my life. She came up to me, looked at me straight on and said, you know, I don't think that you're facing that your marriage was in the dark.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I instantly was so deflated. I was so happy to be back. She couldn't even say, welcome back, sister.
Wow.
Welcome back. It was like, well, you're too happy here. You're too happy considering what you did. See, they needed to have that outward remorse and guilt and shame. You needed to manifest that. But no one ever told you how long you had to manifest that.
Forever.
And that's so unhealthy. There you go.
Yeah. It's forever. It's endless.
Right.
You know, Stuart was never all about, but Gail by extension, it seems like they were never all about helping you through positive reinforcement.
No.
It was all about shame-based control.
Right. So that totally took the wind out of my sails.
Wow.
And then I would listen to Reverend Wormbrand or his wife, Sabina Wormbrand, and just thought, wow. What a gift they are. And we devoured all of their books. You know, he was just such a wonderful writer and such a wonderful man from Russia.
I think he was a
Russian
communist.
Jew. He was yes.
Mm-hmm. Russia. And my mom actually talked about reading, was it The Cross and the Switchblade?
Yeah, no, that's Tom Wilkerson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom Wilkerson.
Okay.
Reverend Wormbrand was the person who then helped James get out later, I think, James LaRue.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just took my licking, you know, just took it and, thought, well, okay, you know, that's the truth. I you know, I've got to face it, I guess. Like, you know, you just internalize it and you try to change who you are according to their standard of how they want you to be defined, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go home and I was so thankful that I lived out of the fellowship. A lot of the wives did. Their husbands left, but they maintained relationships with other wives.
Okay.
And so we lived outside and I created a wives newsletter. So a lot of the wives that lived out yet still wanted to be part, we would write to each other and, you know, say what we're doing this month, how we're growing, what our challenges are, how our children are. And then I'd put it together in a newsletter and send it out to everybody. There might have been about, I don't know, 13 of us that I knew of, you know, that were
okay.
close.
Did Stuart ever get wind of this? Was this?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because I was wondering how that would fly, you know, if he knew that you were doing something positive, for God's sakes.
I'm not sure. I wasn't very meaningful to him. You know, I wasn't one of those in the inner circle.
Well, meaningful, meaning you weren't threatening enough to him, probably.
Right.
Because he was really concerned with people who are mostly threatening to him.
Sure. Yeah.
So then how did your parents react to this? I mean, did they just kind of keep quiet about it? Did you ever speak with them openly about your concerns or what the group did for you positively? You know, how did that intertwine with your family life?
They were thankful that I left, and I never did talk to them about it. I never shared with them, here's why I left. I think they knew, you know, they must have known she's had enough and she wants to get married and have children. And then shortly thereafter, I had my second child, a son. And sometimes I would bring them to the meetings, and they remember being in the nursery. They have nothing really good to say about it, you know, but they do remember. Yeah.
That's funny because I remember mostly positive things, but I was so little. So it's very hard to tell.
Right.
It's just images and shadows and different things, taking baths and, you know, but nothing, at least nothing horrific, you know, comes to mind in the nursery setting that I can remember.
Right.
But
right.
Stuart's kids, were they around at that time? This is always interesting to me because my mom and dad never really speak of his kids. They were sort of separated from the group so much, even though all the other kids were grouped together.
They were there off and on.
They
depending.
Were. Okay.
I think there were times when he actually got custody of his children or a couple of them at any given time. I'm not really that sure about it, but I know that they were kind of a mystery to me, his children.
And to my family as well, which was really interesting, you know. And you also mentioned a couple of times you wanted to get married, and so that was part of leaving the group. Could you not get married in the group at this point? I know later in the Kobu, especially James LaRue's time there, he speaks of the fact that they put a lockdown on all marriages or relationships. Now, when my family was in there very early, in the early to late 70s, there were a lot of families forming and staying in the group. So you could get married, stay, you could have kids and stay. But that actually caused, we think, a lot of people to leave because your loyalties would change. And so I wonder, was that starting to happen when you were there? Or
there were no marriages. I remember one couple being married. One couple got married when I was young, when I was a teenager. And I'm not even sure how long they stayed in the fellowship. But yeah, no one was allowed to be married. You know, I personally think Stuart, I understand the economic reasons that have been talked about in another podcast. Mm-hmm. And that may be it. But I also think he wanted the attention of a lot of the younger women. He wanted to be the sole, you know, the king. He really wanted that for himself.
I agree. I think that was a huge part of it. And he wanted to ensure that he could browbeat the men without anyone coming to their defense, like a wife or someone in a serious relationship with them. He wanted to be the only man who was, you know, held in esteem in these women's eyes. It's just amazing to me how many years of life so many people lost and had to, you know, with no relationship possibilities after that. That is staggering to me.
Mm-hmm. So true.
What shame
I remember,
can do.
Yeah. I must have been 17 when he married Gail, and he did get married in front of the fellowship, I believe. But I wasn't able to be there because I still, you know, was living at home, going to high school. And one of my friends, someone I was very, very close to there was a picture of it. And we had like a little newspaper going around at that time. And there was a picture of Stuart and Gail. And of course, she was beautiful and had her bouquet. And I remember my friend looking at the picture and saying to me, that's who we have to become, the right woman. And so, see, the church, one of the symbols of a church is a right woman. Mm-hmm. So that's, and Stuart would use Gail as an example of that. So he left, of course, the wrong woman, his wife, who he was cheating on.
With Gail.
Right, because she wouldn't put up with him. So now he's got, quote, this right woman. And we all needed to grow as a church to be the right woman.
Wow.
Not a false harlot, as is mentioned in you know, Proverbs.
And when you look back on that now, you can see that it was really just this guy who is cheating on his wife and finding another subservient woman, you know, to put up with his crap.
Yes. She was a very gentle soul.
Mm-hmm. My mom described, she knew Shirley and she knew Gail. You know, she was there through the transition, and she was there when Stuart said he was getting divorced and told all of his lies about Shirley. She also knew that Stuart met Shirley when she was an orphan at about 14 years old. And he actually kind of lured her from an orphanage. I mean, the guy's a pedophile in my book.
Yep. Oh,
and
yeah.
And he always had her dressed in these really like little kid Shirley Temple dresses and really kind of strange get-ups. And then, started stepping out on her with Gail. And I think some people in the cult witnessed that, but never spoke up freely. Mm-hmm. And then really did Shirley dirty with those kids, you know, getting custody and saying lies about her. And of course, power dynamics were so much different back then, too.
Yes.
It's just so rotten, you know, hearing about what happened to me to Shirley and those kids. And I understand, I know it's not confirmed, but you mentioned, and others have sort of alluded to this on different Facebook groups, that his kids were really not speaking with him or didn't have a relationship with him right up until the end. Right. Stuart just passed away in October, which we can also talk about, but...
Right. That's what I understand. That meant several of them, I think there were five, were not close to him at all. And what one of his sons actually commented on the Facebook group that he hadn't spoken to him in 3 years.
I saw that. Was that the son, and we don't have to name him, that I read a police report that was beaten so badly he was sent to a children's hospital. He was beaten so badly with a board by members of the Kobu. Under Stewart's instruction, although they deny it, and Stuart denied it, and they were actually charged.
Yeah. You know, I remember hearing about that. It doesn't surprise me. Stuart had everyone do, you know, his dirty work.
We'll pause here for now, but join us for the continuing story on the next episode of Cult Talk. Also, join the listener conversation over on the Cult Talk with Aaron Martin Facebook page. Follow at Cult Talk on Twitter and Instagram, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast from any platform and leave us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. Cult Talk is written and hosted by me, Aaron Martin, and produced by Dan McInerney. See the show notes attached to this episode for all links to resources and social media associated with Cult Talk.